ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Who is more powerful? A tech billionaire with 181 million followers on his own social media platform, or the elected leader of a nation of 26 million people?
That's the big question being asked right now as the Australian government takes on Elon Musk.
And it isn't just dominating our dinner conversations. It's being talked about all over the world.
Do we govern ourselves, or do they, big tech, really govern us?
I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue.
This is Global Roaming.
Yes, well, Hamish, this has been the big story of the week, sort of exploding before our eyes and growing, but sort of Hydra-like in terms of a story that develops all these different component parts.
It's dominated headlines here in Australia, obviously, but globally as well. And I think it's worth just hearing a snapshot of how the world's reacted to this.
We have a war of words between Australia's Prime Minister and Elon Musk.
Anthony Albanese branded the ex-owner as an arrogant billionaire who thinks he's above the law.
Social media platforms have become so powerful nowadays. They can influence elections. They can shape public opinion. So every government wants to control them.
And it raises a question that governments around the world are dealing with, but it's come into sharpest focus in Australia, about who is more powerful, the duly elected government of the day or an American tech billionaire?
Yes, and some of the commentators, interestingly, went on to remind their listeners that actually Australia has in the past played a sort of forward role, very much punching above our weight in some of these standard-setting areas. And they quoted, for instance, plain packaging on cigarettes and so on as something where we went far beyond what would appear to have been our purview or our realm.
As a small country, you mean?
As a small country, yes.
There's different dimensions to this, though, because there's the question of sovereignty and whether a nation state has the ability to enforce its laws on a multinational tech giant. But then there's also the free speech conversation, which is what Elon Musk has been trying to make this about. He's clearly taken exception to our e-safety commissioner, Julian Mangrant, calling her a censorship commissar. Of course, she did work for Twitter at one point. It should probably be noted. And I guess there are dimensions of this that remind me of being in the Middle East during the Arab Spring, right? So in Egypt during the revolution, which eventually unseated Mubarak, there was a lot of opposition from that regime to Twitter. It was called a Twitter revolution. And so you can see that there are going to be other countries looking at what a democracy like Australia does, trying to enforce its rules and take down orders on a big social media giant. And you can kind of understand why those companies might say, look, we don't want individual nations picking and choosing what can be available on our platform, either domestically or globally. And that's, I think, critical to the legal dimension of this, which is that what Australia is asking Twitter to do is not just prevent that content from being seen in Australia. It is a global takedown order.
This is what is so challenging. It's really a comment on the nature of the media that is underway now. And that's what makes this such a sort of a marker boy. It could be anyway. I mean, it's hard to say. And there are sort of gorgeous anomalies here. What was the platform that our Prime Minister chose to use to comment first on the Wakeley, the whole question that's at the core of this, that's the stabbing of the bishop? He chose X. Yeah. His media people chose X to make his initial remarks, and it got straight out into the media sphere. So, you know, he'll have to think about that, I think.
So we are about to delve into this much further, but I think it's worth just laying out how we got here, because there's been an enormous flurry of information and news in recent weeks. Of course, initially there was the Bondi Junction attack, and so much social media content, very graphic material, emerged from that, a lot of it seen by children. And then what really triggered this battle with Elon Musk is the Wakeley incident earlier this month. So a stabbing at an Assyrian church that was live streamed. Allegedly, it was a 16-year-old boy. That ended up as social media content, WhatsApp content, which then, it said, led to this riot of 2,000 people. Australia then, through the eSafety Commission, argued for specific pieces of content to be removed from X and other platforms. The other platforms seemed to comply pretty rapidly. X did, but is challenging the position. And that's how we've come to this particular point. And the question is raised of whether Australia can have this much authority over a global platform.
Which makes our guest today absolutely pertinent, Dr. Alexis Wachowski. She's a professor at Columbia University, and she's an expert on the intersection of technology, government and power. In 2020, she published a book called The Information Trade, How Tech Companies Act Like Countries. And she'll develop her idea about net states, which I think will really have you thinking hard about what's coming next in our lives. Here she is now.
Alexis, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been watching this battle unfold between our elected PM, Anthony Albanese, and the unelected leader of X, Elon Musk, play out. It's been news where you are too. Who's got the power? Who's going to win this?
That's a really great question. And I think that we're kind of seeing the answer play out in real time. You can have any kind of government. You know, the prime minister can say anything they like and pass any sort of laws and regulations with court orders. But ultimately, nothing can be done outside of the borders of that country. Elon Musk, on the other hand, has access to a lot more levers of power because he can work globally. So I don't really want to frame it in terms of who's going to win. But I think that Elon Musk holds more options than anybody in any government, even in Australia.
This is you write in your book about net states, and that's exactly what he has come to preside over. Could you explain what you mean by that term, please?
Absolutely. So I've come from a diplomatic background, having worked in the U.S. Department of State, where we talk about countries with the more formal name nation states. And one of the reasons that I chose the term net states is to just suggest, you know what, nation states or countries, they're not the only game in town anymore. That big tech has become a global geopolitical power broker, and we need to start treating them accordingly. And back when I wrote the first article that turned into the book, there was no such thing as tech diplomacy or tech ambassadors, tech diplomats. This is something that's occurred in recent years, and I think it's a sign of the world and governments of the world taking this idea seriously, that these tech giants have not just products and services, but a tremendous amount of power, and we need more ways to engage with them, just like we would other nations.
You've advocated for these tech diplomats or ambassadors in your work, and it's a really interesting idea, I guess, in the context of what we're all witnessing unfold here in Australia. But our government has put in place something called an e-safety commissioner, which seems a bit more like a sort of cop on the beat rather than a diplomat. And Elon Musk's clearly taken quite a disliking to Julian Mangrant. He's described her as the commissar of censorship in Australia. She's actually an ex-Twitter employee herself. What's your view? Would a diplomat help a carrot, or do you need a really big stick to wave at these guys?
That's an excellent question, and it does not surprise me that this is a former employee of Twitter that he's going after. He seems to take things very personally, very much like you would see in some sort of autocratic nation. So I think that there is a distinction between organizations like the eSafety Commission. We absolutely need those who can work kind of operationally on regulations, on fines, on the legal kind of levers that are available. But we also need other avenues, which is where diplomacy comes in. In traditional government operations, you've got regulations and fine on one side, and then you've got dialogue and discourse on the other side. So this is not to say that diplomats would be better than regulators. This is to say we need every tool in the toolbox, because nothing we've done has really worked thus far.
See, he has yielded, Musk, I read, occasionally. He yielded when the Indians basically threatened to throw ex-people in prison, similarly in Brazil. So it obviously can work when the book is thrown at them or suggested to be. I mean, if he just says no, that he doesn't intend to comply with the Australian laws and requests, what tools does Australia have left in its toolbox?
I think that there's actually quite a lot of tools that have yet to be explored. It doesn't surprise me to hear that he's, you know, yielded in these cases with really massive populations like in India, because that represents a larger user base with greater economic implications if they were to fall out of favor, for instance, or they were going to have a geo kind of block around using his services. But I think that governments need to be thinking as creatively as possible. We need carrots, we need sticks, we need fines and regulations, we need diplomacy, but we also need partnerships and alliances. So I think that some of the options that have not really been explored thus far are who else is in this kind of boat? Clearly, the large markets like India and Brazil, the tech companies are going to be a little bit more willing to make them happy so they don't lose access to that kind of economic opportunity. But in places like Australia, Google had a moment in, for instance, with Canada, where they threatened to turn off, you know, access to their services. These smaller markets, I think if they join together, could be a much more powerful force to counteract people like Elon Musk.
So do you dispute the Musk framing of this as a freedom of speech argument? Do you say this is actually about, this is about money because the polarizing content drives the revenue?
I think this is another both and situation. I think it's convenient to lean on the free speech angle of this, but it doesn't make it untrue. There is this possibility that this is a precedent setting kind of case. And we all may think for this particular content coming from a democratic country saying we don't want this to be available, that that's a good plan. But if that precedent has been set, then what is a person leading these organizations like Elon Musk to say when an autocratic country or a dictator or tyrant comes forth and says, I don't want this content out there for my people? So it is a free speech issue, but it's not just that.
Well,
there's also, I think, this very serious economic part.
That is the actual dilemma, isn't it? I mean, that's the argument that Musk says. This is overreach. Australia's trying to sort of take this down all around the world. Mm. That's not appropriate. I don't know whether it's appropriate for his business or for the whole thing. I mean, how are you seeing that next stage of development?
Again, this is a situation where it's complex. It's easier operationally from Twitter's, or sorry, X's standpoint, to just say, okay, we're going to cut off access to this footage in Australia. But of course, there's VPNs, there's other kinds of ways that digital content can be found, even if you put those kinds of blocks around it. And this is why even the other big, you know, tech companies like Google and Microsoft, who have complied with requests to take down this footage, we're still seeing it on YouTube, which is owned by Google. We're still seeing it on other kinds of products and services, because once the content is out there, it's very, very hard to pull it back.
Can I just clarify, yeah, sure, something with you, though? Because I think the eSafety Commission's takedown order is a global takedown order, and that's where this is in dispute, right? Because they're not just asking for it to be geo-blocked in Australia. They're saying we want this removed in totality from the platform, this particular post.
Right, and I understand the request is to remove it from anyone on earth being able to access the footage. Is this overreach? I think every other country on earth would say, I have the right to say what my people can see or not. So yes, in that sense, it would be overreach. At the same time, is it even functionally possible? So this is one of the areas where I feel like the fact that this is a precedent-setting case makes it almost irrelevant whether it's overreach or not, because it's not truly, I think, doable. Even if Musk took the content down right now, it's already been copied how many millions of times around the globe? So in some ways, this is a kind of a legal scholar semantics precedent issue, but I don't think it's actually possible unless you delete it the instant it arrives.
So that brings us right back to the core thing then about whether sort of new codes have to be applied to these net states that you're describing. Alexis, what happened after the terrible Christchurch massacre? Does that offer some sort of guidelines about where we might go next usefully? I don't know whether all the personalities were different at the time, I think, but that might be something that you could comment on.
Absolutely. And I think this is a really great example of how the tech companies, the net states, and governments can work together. What we saw after Christchurch was the Christchurch call, of course, where the various tech companies involved at the time, it was Facebook and YouTube primarily, Twitter to another extent, but Elon Musk was not in leadership at the time. They all came together to say, we need to collaborate and figure out ways both politically and also technologically to make sure that once content is out there that is dangerous, it can be retracted, and that if it pops up someplace else, we have a way to track it. So they created an organization that would everybody would voluntarily create what's called a hash, which is like a digital fingerprint. So if a video popped up on YouTube and then YouTube decided to take it down and then it cropped up again later on Facebook, Facebook would say, oh, we recognize this, and they would be able to take it down as well. So it's both a political solution and a technological solution working very nicely together.
And it worked.
I think
did
that
it?
Would be a really, it's working pretty well. The thing is, it requires all of the technology platforms to agree to do this. And Elon Musk doesn't seem particularly interested in playing that way.
Something that Jerry and I have observed this week, I think probably we all have, is that this isn't just an Australia story. This story has been quite big globally. Help us understand why that is. How big has the story been where you are? And why are other leaders, other countries watching this so closely?
It's an excellent question. It is absolutely something that the world is watching. And one of the reasons for that is that everybody's wondering who's going to figure this out. Because as we discussed earlier, it's really tricky to find that line between what is free speech and permissible and what is harmful and dangerous for this stability of a society.
So in your
view, nobody wants to be the one to get it wrong.
In your view, is this a power struggle of genuine consequence?
I do believe it is. And I think that this is not just the only time this will happen. I don't think this will be something where one country makes a decision and it is solved for all time. But I think that we are, with every instance like this, Australia right now is in a moment, whether it likes it or not, where they're able to take a stand. And that's what I think that this request for a global takedown is. They're saying, we as nation states, we are elected by the people, and therefore we have more power and credibility in asking for this kind of protection for our people.
Are people like Zuckerberg and Musk and so on and Google, are they malicious actors or sort of very self-interested actors? Because, you know, the tragedy is the violence appears to, you know, boost their business. Or are they out of their depth? I mean, they say they're not publishers. You know, we're publishers. We work in the ABC. We're boundaried and we know it. It's in our DNA by regulation everywhere. They say they're a new industry. Now, isn't this the core of it? Somehow trying to, in terms of moving into this next stage, someone's got to start persuading, well, I would argue, someone's got to start persuading them that's the business they're in.
This is an excellent point. And I think you're right in a couple of fronts here. On the one hand, they did not start off as a news industry, but it's been quite some time since they've been in this kind of position. This is not the first time we've had a conversation globally about what content is out there and whose job it is to regulate it or monitor it. So this argument that they have no responsibility, the people who run these tech companies, I think is a very old one, and I don't think anyone really buys it anymore. But when you ask about kind of the character of the people who are running the show, Musk, for instance, or Zuckerberg or others, I think it's very much like we see in political leadership. They're not all the same. So for instance, Microsoft has traditionally, in the last several years at least, been quite a responsible actor in calling for alliances between governments and tech companies. Microsoft was the first tech company to open up an office at the United Nations, not as a lobbying organization, but as a diplomatic one. So I think that we need to think about the leaders of these tech organizations, these net states, as you would different country leaders. Some of them are going to be good partners, and some of them really have, I think, their own plans in mind.
Are you, though, by taking that approach, affording them a degree of credibility and status that they shouldn't rightly enjoy? I mean, they're not elected. They're not responsible or answerable to large populations in the way that a nation state government might be if it's a democracy.
That's an excellent point, and that's precisely, I think, why we need to think about this differently than just a traditional business. I would say recognizing the power that they already have is not giving them legitimacy. It's just being honest about the kind of power that they have. They have the ability to work differently in different countries as they like. Nation states do not generally have that kind of reach. Even the greatest empires don't have that kind of ability. So my suggestion that we look at these big tech companies, these net states, as geopolitical actors at a level like a country, is not to say that they should be, or that their leaders should not be held accountable. It's just that I think that's a lot what they look like and a lot how they're behaving.
But what about like next week? What you're talking about is going to take a while. If you had Prime Minister Albanese's ear, for instance, what would you advise him to do next? Anything different, Alexis?
Absolutely. I would say to continue to take a strong stand and start making phone calls to your friends around the world, because all of the other democratic countries who are out there are watching right now, terrified that this is going to happen to them next, really glad that it hasn't happened to them right now. And if he can build alliances in this moment of global spotlight and global concern, then every one of these countries, including Australia, including his leadership, will be bolstered and strengthened.
Should a country, though, like Australia, whether it's the Safety Commissioner or the Prime Minister, should they ultimately be willing to throttle access to a particular platform if they don't comply? I mean, that's the extreme end point of this, right? And it probably seems pretty far-fetched right now. But if this is the contest that you're describing, does sovereignty matter? Do you have the authority to create and enforce laws in your own land? Should they be willing to pull that trigger?
I think they must. They must consider every option they have, because the other side already has done so. We've already seen instances where Twitter, X, Facebook, Google, et cetera, have cut off access to entire nations, including Australia at some points. So nation states must also be willing to say, we can do that game too.
Play hardball.
We can. Yes, exactly. And economically, it would not feel good for the tech companies to lose that user base, because ultimately, and this is where we do have power, all of us, not just the leaders of nation states, but every single one of us, citizens and users, any social media platform with no users is a ghost town. So there is something that even as political leadership tries to figure out what they're going to do, users themselves can withdraw their attention and their content, and that will, if organized and at scale, will also have an impact.
I'm glad I left.
Well, that's just something to add to the little inbox. Just imagine how much the prime ministers of various states are not looking to do this at the moment as they battle with everything else. But I'll take your point. Alexis, thank you very much. This has been a fabulous conversation.
Thank you so much. This is not a solved problem. It's really, really complicated. I'm sorry you're all in it right now. But it is also, the whole world is watching what Australia is doing right now. And I really do think it is an opportunity.
So, Hamish, what did you take out of that sort of macro, micro in terms of your own personal behaviour and the way governments ought to be thinking?
Well, I mean, I'm a little surprised that she went as far as to say that you do have to just be prepared to shut them down, because they have cut us off at various points and other countries when it suited them to do so. I mean, it seems like a pretty big leap to go from where we are now to throttling access to a particular platform because they're not complying with an order. That seems really big. But if this contest is as consequential as what Alexis is saying, maybe that's something that we need to be discussing the possibility of and thinking about quite seriously.
Maybe we do. And maybe it is basic values are at stake. There was a great line by a man called Michael Pelly writing in the Financial Review. An old saying about free speech is that it doesn't mean you can shout fire in a theatre, causing a huge panic. Musk is the guy who laughs at the people running out of the theatre because they didn't check if there was actually a fire. You know, I mean, to me, that's the way this, there's a lot here that matters about what we take as order, fairness, tranquility, rights. It really does encapsulate an awful lot. And I thought that she was inviting us to say, this is not going to be over fast, and you've got to go to that extra mile of working out what this all means for life as we know it.
Are you leaving any social media platforms as a result of this conversation?
Well, no, you see, I'm a very small user of social media platforms, and I'm on a very nice one called LinkedIn.
And you don't use the others?
No.
Yeah, okay.
I don't.
Yeah, I left Twitter some years ago. It was sort of a weird thing to do at the time, but actually life is much better for it.
Do you find that?
Ah, 100%. I read more. I don't get sort of carried away with the noise. I think actually it makes you a better journalist.
Yeah, this is what
I hope so.
I have read. I'm sure that's true, Hamish.
Perceptions may differ. Before we get to recommendations, Geraldine, some incredible feedback from you on our episode with Anthony Scaramucci, the Mooch. Thank you very much for all of your correspondence on that. I think it's fair to say that he surprised a lot of you. Mm. One listener, Clarissa from Mudgee, says, who would have thought he was such a well-read person? Just goes to show we shouldn't form opinions or judgments quickly. Geraldine, she also congratulated you on just one recommendation. Isn't that a first, she says. What have you got for us?
Salman Rushdie has brought out a book called Knife. And Salman Rushdie, of course, had this incredible attack out of the blue, 4 years ago? And he survived 17 slashes with him at a knife, lost an eye, very, very lucky to survive. And he's written this apparently marvellous book. Sarah Ferguson had a very good interview with him on 7:30, which I commend to people. And also, Erica Wagner, who is a friend of his, wrote a beautiful piece in the London Daily Telegraph, reprinted in the Financial Review, which you might like to look at, because it's about joy. It's about seeing a man survive. And of course, it's a knife attack with all of those implications at the moment in Australian life. It boosted me.
Yeah.
Boosted me.
Good. And by the way, I should say, well done on Sunday. You obviously moderated events in Bondi commemorating the attacks there. An important moment for the community in Sydney and Australia more broadly, I think, and from all of us that watched you. Thank you for doing
thank
that.
You. Thank you, Hamish.
You did so well. My recommendation this week is on the Trump theme. Lachlan Cartwright is an Australian journalist who works in the United States now with The Hollywood Reporter, but he was at the National Enquirer during the time that Donald Trump was first running for the presidency. Now, the National Enquirer has become critical to Trump's criminal trial in New York at the moment because of this so-called catch and kill campaign that took place, allegedly, in the run-up to the 2016 election. And what this involved was the National Enquirer essentially sussing out stories of scandal that were being pitched about Trump. And instead of just paying for them themselves and publishing them, it's alleged that these were handed off to Trump's acolytes, his legal team, who could then pay people off for the stories and get them to sign NDAs.
Wow.
And so there's an Australian, quite incredibly, that's really at the centre of this in many ways.
Oh, that is a very good recommendation.
It's called What I Saw Working at the National Enquirer During Donald Trump's Rise. It's in the New York Times, but it's also, there's a podcast version of it if you don't want to pay to get through the paywall.
Did it depress you or did it boost you?
Look, it was just a fascinating inside read into sort of how this whole operation was said to have operated. And, it's pretty – we've heard a lot about the misdeeds of the media here in Australia in recent weeks and months. It's clear that it doesn't just happen here.
No, quite so. No, sometimes you can sit there reading and you think, oh, my God, I think I might sort of go off and live in a hut.
You can't go and live in the hut because we've got to go to the Sydney Writers' Festival in a few weeks' time, Geraldine. 25th of May, Jerry and I will be live on stage discussing Australia's twin perils. We'd love you to come and visit and say hello and throw us a question if you can. And if you want to continue your correspondence, we love hearing from you, global.roaming@abc.net.au. That address is also in the notes of each episode.
Have a good week.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Taryn Priyadko as well. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.